last week in a sermon about the ways that religions inevitably influence one another over time. We explored the influence, one of the examples we explored was the influence of paganism on Christianity. From the choice to celebrate Jesus' birth near winter solstice to Christians retaining many pagan holiday trappings. So from Yule logs to feasting to decorating evergreen trees, we get these traditions around Christmas that predate the historical Jesus by millennia. Similarly, we saw the ways that the word Easter comes from the fertility goddess Estra, hence they carried over pagan practices that while we're Christians are supposed to be remembering the stories of Jesus' resurrection, we get these carried over pagan practices of decorating Easter eggs and having children take pictures with oversized bunnies. Both eggs and bunnies are fertility symbols. So, and although the pagan practice on Christianity continues to today, as Christianity became the dominant religion of the Roman Empire, the complex relationship between paganism and Christianity was increasingly covered up. As often happens with competing groups, the leaders of one group, in this case Christian leaders, began to define themselves, so to establish a more solid identity for themselves by defining themselves in opposition to another group, in this case the pagans. The result is a classic case of othering, of creating an us versus them dynamic, exaggerating differences between two groups, and building solidarity within one group by scapegoating another. Fast forward 2,000 years, and when many people in the Christian-influenced West encounter the word pagan, common associations include ungodly, irreligious, infidel, idolatrous. You may or may not consider those negative things. That's a discussion for another time. Those stereotypes reflect not an impartial reality, but whether the ways that self-appointed enemies of paganism tried to define paganism. In contrast, pagans would have defined themselves at first very differently. To turn the tables, many people associate words like hypocritical, bigoted against homosexuality, sheltered and judgmental with the word Christian, which is different from how many Christians would choose to define themselves, or how Christians at their best for centuries have stood on the side of love, of forgiveness, of mercy. So what does paganism mean? What does Christianity mean? Well, it depends both on whom you ask and when. There have been significant shifts in the meaning of the words Christian and pagan, starting in particular with the Roman Emperor Constantine's strategic, some would say cynical, support of Christianity in the 4th century, but that's almost 300 years after the life of the historical Jesus. As historians have shown, for thousands of years before Jesus, and even for centuries after Jesus, the people who have come to be viewed in retrospect as the pagans had no name for themselves in that period and did not conceive of themselves as any sort of unified confession. Pagans had a tremendous diversity of beliefs and practices. Not all pagans were polytheists. They had no common creed, and they observed or ignored gods, rituals, festivals according to their own individual and local inclinations. That being said, pagan continues to be used as a term even by historians of that ancient pre-Jesus time because it's really preferable to what would be a much longer phrase, non-Jewish devotees of traditional Mediterranean gods. So we tend to just say pagans. But historically speaking, again, even for centuries after the life of the historical Jesus, the Latin word paganus simply meant peasant. A pagus was a country district. A paganus was someone who lived there. Likewise, the word heathen originally meant someone from the heath, someone who lived in the country, not the city. As with the word pagan, it was only much later that the word heathen acquired negative connotations, such as infidel, idolater, or heretic. A major reason that these country-dwelling pagans and heathens came to be pejoratives was that Christianity, for the most part, was an urban phenomenon. The rate of people converting to Christianity was tremendously higher in the cities of the Roman world than in the country. So those pagani who remained in the heath and continued to celebrate their traditional individual and local gods became increasingly stigmatized and grouped together as this non-Christian other. And as strange as it may seem to us today, historians invite us to see that pagans, in a very real sense, did not exist until well after the life of the historical Jesus. Now, the word paganus did exist, meaning peasant, but it didn't have anything like the meanings it has come to have over time. Before the meaning of pagan shifted, in the words of one historian, there were, of course, people who lived here and there. There were people who spoke this or that language, people who were rich or poor, people who attended this or that festival because they enjoyed it, and people who were so tired and poor and ill that they just got through the day as best they could. It was the Christians who came along and called all of those diverse people by one name. Centuries at least would pass still before anyone firmly outside the Christian community ever used that word to describe him or herself. Even more time would pass before anyone would not only use that word, but accept it and take a little pride in it. Another way of thinking about this dynamic is that if you were able to travel by time machine, meet Julius Caesar, and ask him what it was like for him to be a pagan, to be a paganus, he wouldn't have understood what you could possibly mean. No one else would have understood either. Among other things, Julius Caesar was not a peasant. I don't want to go too much into this, but we've talked about this before. A very similar dynamic is true of the word Hinduism, that we think kind of Hinduism is this ancient, venerable tradition. Indeed, there are ancient, venerable traditions of people around the Indus River, but it wasn't until European colonialism came in and said, we need a name for all those people, and we said, that's Hinduism. But of course, now that's come to be adopted. It's even more confusing because now many Hindus use it too, but historically speaking, Hinduism is a construct of European colonialism, very similar to paganism in dynamics. Returning to the present day, I'm grateful again to John for sharing with us some about his journey into the old paths. A common theme when people describe what draws them to paganism is gender egalitarianism. A strong tradition of both male and female aspects of the divine and the gods and goddess archetypes, as opposed to the Abrahamic traditions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, which have a strong patriarchal bias at seeing the divine principally in masculine terms. Another common theme is the connection and transformative power that many people experience through participatory pagan rituals. Singing, dancing, creating altars and other sacred spaces and rites. Yet another common theme, and one that resonates with me most strongly from the pagan tradition, is the emphasis on connection to the earth, and in particular on the turning of the seasons known as the wheel of the year. If you imagine each year as a circle, most of us are familiar with the four major quadrants: winter, spring, summer, and fall. Paganism adds the additional nuance of what is known as cross-quarter days, so further dividing each of those quarters, so we divide the year into eighths. In between winter solstice and spring equinox is Imbolc, an opportunity to celebrate that after winter solstice, finally, the days are lengthening again. This pagan holiday has been secularized in our society as Groundhog's Day. In between spring equinox and summer solstice is Beltane, most famous for the tradition of dancing around the Maypole, another pagan holiday that has been secularized in this case as May Day. In between summer solstice and fall equinox is Lammas, on the opposite side of the wheel from Imbolc. Lammas is an opportunity to ritually commemorate the days growing darker. In between fall equinox and winter solstice is Samhain, also known as All Hallows' Eve or Halloween, a time in particular for remembering your ancestors. And in our technology-filled 24/7 world of connection and almost constantly available artificial light, the 8 points on the wheel of the year offer a way of redirecting our attention back to the cycle of the seasons and how those rhythms affect us. The value of this earth-centered way of being in the world was recognized officially by the Unitarian Universalist Association in 1995 when a sixth source was added to our living tradition. Spiritual teachings of earth-centered traditions which celebrate the sacred circle of life and instruct us to live in harmony with the rhythms of nature. We actually only needed the teal hymnals this morning, but perhaps it's auspicious that the gray were put out as well. If you can do this or not, it doesn't really matter. I'm telling you the truth, but you can confirm if you'd like. If you turn inside the beginning of the gray hymnal, you'll see the copyright is 1993, so that's 2 years before we added our sixth source. So if you have one of when we first bought these gray hymnals, you'll see early in the hymnal that only 5 sources are added. But if you have one of the second printings of these hymnals, and about half of them are the second printings, you'll see they came out after 95, so the 6 sources added. You'll also notice in the table of contents of both the teal hymnal and the gray hymnal that our hymns are divided into our 6 sources. So the earlier hymns are all the first source of direct experience, and the second source, the second part is prophets all the way through to our 6th source, though of course only the teal hymnal has the 6 source hymns in it explicitly. So that 1995 date makes 2015, this year, the 20th anniversary of paganism and other indigenous religions being explicitly added as our 6th source. So it is auspicious that this year is also the first time that our growing covenant of UU Pagans group here at UUCF is hosting a pagan Pride Day. Pagans are coming out of the broom closet. Modern pagan pride events began in the early 1990s and have grown to include tens of thousands of people annually. The price of admission is traditionally not money, but rather a contribution to a local food bank. In 2013, there were 98 pagan pride events across the U.S., Canada, Mexico, Brazil, the Dominican Republic, Rome, and Austria. 2013 event attendance was more than 65,000 people, an increase in attendance by over 20,000 when compared to 2012. This is a growing movement. The event's total in 2013 collected a total of almost 40,000 pounds of food to donate to local food banks. For decades, pagans have been wrongly accused of practicing devil worship and performing black magic, you know, in the tradition of Cotton Mather and the extremist among the Puritans. But in reality, most pagans enjoy a religion that emphasizes respect for nature, for humanity, for oneself. Modern paganism or neo-paganism is a growing religious movement based on a combination of ancient polytheism, modern eco-spirituality, and reverence for the divine as both masculine and feminine. If you're curious to learn more about the various workshops, events, musicians, and vendors that will contribute to our Pagan Pride Day this coming Saturday here at UUCF, you can visit frederickpaganpride.com. If not, that's fine, too. As a UU congregation, we're a big tent. Here in this, the beauty and challenge of our pluralistic community is that here at UUCF, you can be a Christian, you can be a pagan, you can be a Christian and a pagan, and you can be none of the above. One reason in particular that paganism, that sixth source of earth-centered tradition, fits so well within Unitarian Universalism is it connects with that goal, that principle of seeking world community, that a lot of developmental theorists talk about the need to move from egocentrism to ethnocentrism to some sort of globocentrism that sees all humans as connected as part of one human family, so that we are all, Ken Wilber, one developmental theorist, says we're all born little fascists, like, you know, little egocentrists, and that we learn, hopefully, unless we're sociopaths, we learn to identify with our tribe, right? So you move to be ethnocentric, but part of what we were seeing before is that those battles that develop between the Christians and the pagans, or between the Hindus and the Muslims, or between, you know, these perceptions around black black and white or slave and free, that the between men and women, right? Between straight and LGBT, that those divisions can be ethnocentric. But what Earth-centered traditions invite us to see, and what other, you know, what humanism invites us to see, is to make those larger connections, to emphasize our commonalities, and not to use our much more minor differences to bludgeon one another. So in that spirit of seeking connection and compassion, as you leave this place this morning, continue your journey walking in love. Care for one another and care for this one earth. Do justice and make peace. And know that whatever taste or touch you've had in this time and place of hope, of love, of peace or joy, that goes with you out into the world. We're different for having spent this time together. So live boldly and with thanksgiving. Go in peace.